Today is Thursday, October 22nd, 2015. We're going to hear Rav Moshe Soloveitchik Shir and Parshas Lech Lecha. Parshas Lech Lecha,
Parshas Lech Lecha. Ladies, gentlemen. Anyway, I'd like to welcome everybody. In case you don't know, we're Flacian.
No.
It's very good.
Yeah.
Very good.
Does anybody want more corned beef?
Yeah, it's very good.
Anybody? Raise your hand. Okay.
I just said it was very good.
I didn't have any coffee. I didn't have any coffee.
I'm going to ask everybody to please take their phones and remind them to please
vibrate.
You can vibrate them or you can shut them off, whatever you prefer. So we would appreciate if you wouldn't interrupt the class with your phone. I want to thank those that helped to set up the room for us. Thank you. There are generous people in this room, and I think I could say that about all of you. One time or another, each and every one of you brought something, and so that does continue on. Paper goods and plasticware and things of that nature keep on coming in, and I'd like to thank those people who have taken the time for thinking about this class and its needs. I want to take the opportunity also to mention that just a couple of minutes after the class, we're going to be davening Maariv. We'll need pretty much everybody's help, if you don't mind. Ladies, you can help.
Yes, I can.
And also, I'd like to take the opportunity to wish everybody a good Erev Shabbos and a good Shabbos. And if you should see...
Yeah, no shear next week.
No shear next week. No shear next week. There will not be a class. Would you be able to send out a message to everybody? And
the following week will be a shear.
So I want to wish everybody a good year of Shabbos and a good Shabbos. And I want to thank everybody for coming. Thank you. Oh, by the way, I'd like to thank Young Israel for allowing us to have this class here. And in particular, the rabbi who has caused this class to be successful by being here all these years. And of course, I definitely want to thank Rev Soloveitchik for all his devotion and time and effort and his wonderful way about him. So, thanks, Rev. Mm-hmm. Which I thank you, too.
Okay. I thank you, too.
Thanks.
Thanks.
The class is being sponsored today.
Oh, yeah. This class is being sponsored by Dr. Harris Goldenberg in memory of his father, Yonah ben Yisrael, whose yard site is on the 9th of Cheshvan. One of the unfortunate trends that I have noticed lately creeping into Orthodoxy is the acceptance in some form or shape of Bible criticism. My father told me years ago that a certain professor came to my grandfather, and he asked my grandfather, is it okay for him to study Bible criticism? Why did he want to study Bible criticism? He didn't believe in the Bible criticism, but he wanted to study Bible criticism because he said kidei leida masha tashif. In other words, if somebody says something, he wanted to know how to respond. My father was a young fellow at the time, and he remembers that my grandfather told the person, you can't study Bible criticism. Now, my father at that time, my father as a youngster, he read about just about everything he'd get his hands on. I mean, my father knew Shakespeare practically by heart, and literature, and especially psychology. He spent, and at that time he was reading Freud's book Moses, and which says things that go against, to put it mildly, that go against our tradition. So he turned to my grandfather and he asked my grandfather, he heard my grandfather say that you're not allowed to study Bible criticism. So he asked my grandfather whether it's mutter for him to read Freud's book. Because Freud said things that, you know, against the Torah and against the... So my grandfather, and I have to point certain things out that shouldn't be taken slightly. My grandfather told my father that he could read Freud. So my father was somewhat... Now, I should point out, there are two separate issues. One issue is the question of the influence and the impact that it would have on the person who's reading. My grandfather obviously felt that even my father, even at a young age, it wouldn't have much of an impact on, in terms of his religious commitment and religious thinking. That doesn't mean that the same would apply to everybody else. You know, every question has to be evaluated depending who you're dealing with. But then, the second question, so then my father asked my grandfather, so what's the difference? Why is it that when it comes to Bible criticism, I can't, one is not allowed to read it? And when it comes to Freud, even though Freud, you know, dismisses certain things that are in the Bible, and certainly in Chazal. By the way, it should be pointed out, you know, when I learned Maseches Brachos with my father, and the last perek deals extensively about the interpretation of dreams. So some of the dreams my father would point out, because my father read Freud, my father would point out that some of the interpretations of the dreams that the Gemara gives, Freud also gave. And about 2 years ago, I was reading an article that they looked at Freud's library, and in the library they found the German translation of Maseches Brachos. Okay. Anyway,
oh gosh,
that just
sure this takes away a little bit.
From who? So, actually, it doesn't take away. In other words, Freud was not a person who was disposed to learning Gemara, to put it. But, nevertheless, he felt that there were things that he was able to benefit from the Gemara. The fact that he didn't give credit to the Gemara, okay, but listen, let me put it to you this way. That's a lot better than a lot of our Jews. I mean, Freud was Jewish also, but he felt there was things that he could learn, so he got a German translation of Maseches Brachos. Anyway, but in any case, so my father asked my grandfather, what's the difference? Why is it that when it comes to Freud, so I'm allowed to read it, but when it comes to Bible criticism, I'm not allowed to read it. So my father said, huh? My grandfather said, I heard it from my father though. My grandfather said to my father, he said, Bible criticism was written with the purpose and the intention of undermining Tanakh. But Freud, it's true, he negates certain things that says in Tanakh, but that wasn't his purpose. His purpose was to write a book about psychology, you know, whatever it is. So in the process, he says so. If my father is not someone that will religiously be influenced by the things that Freud says, so it would be okay for him to read Freud. Then my grandfather asked my father, but why are you so interested in it? No, it's mutter, it's allowed. But why are you so interested? He apparently saw that my father says he finds interesting things there. So my grandfather said, what do you see there? See, he says, it gives an example. Apparently, Freud talks about the two babies. I don't know if this was in this book or other writings. The two mothers that came to Shlomo HaMelech. And each one claiming that the live child was theirs. So Freud says that the bigger proof was not from what the real mother said, give him to the other one, but was from the first mother, for the first or second mother, the mother who said, divide him in half. Divide him in half. And the whole thing about power of hate being greater than the power of love, I think we all know that anyway. Anyway, so my grandfather said to my father, he says, in Yiddish, he said, the Zayda hat gesagt, the Zelbazach. And your grandfather said the same thing. And big shmeel. Reb Chaim said the same thing. So my father said, okay, I'm impressed that Freud was mechaven. I don't know how mechaven he is, that he came up with the same idea as the Zayda, as my grandfather. Okay. So my grandfather said, it's interesting. I still have some. He says, so what? He says, he was smart, then he was smart. That's in other words, my grandfather wasn't impressed just with the fact that someone said something that showed intelligence, that somebody was smart. But okay, so the first time I heard this from my father was years ago, and at that time there was a certain person who gave an interview in the student newspaper of Yeshiva University, and he suggested that they introduce the study of Bible criticism in Yeshiva University. And he made a lot of other suggestions, which my father spoke against. This person made a lot of other suggestions. And this is, I'm talking like in 1966. Today, at that time, it was considered unusual to make these suggestions. Today, it would be considered unusual. Anyway, and my father responded again to everything that was said, but when it came to talking about Bible criticism, my father, you could see almost a loss of temper. And he said an interesting thing. He said that's true, that Spinoza was really the father of Bible criticism. Spinoza was a Jew. But my father said, after Spinoza, in the initial stages, so Bible criticism really was a German science. The main Bible critics in the early stages, my father felt, were the Germans.
Rabbi, yeah. Jewish?
I didn't get that impression. Okay. And my father said, whenever it came to anti-Semitism, he said, before they were able to mete out all these decrees against the Jewish people, so they made a cultural attack or attack on the culture of the Jew. And my father said, when the Germans, and this is predates World War II by 100 years, maybe more, 150 years, but the purpose of Bible criticism in undermining Tanakh, it also was to undermine the Jewish people. The Jewish people were always identified as the people of the book. The less important Tanakh has, the less important the Jewish people become. He said, in a sense, of course, this is many years beforehand, but this set the spirit to undermine the Jew. And the truth of the matter is, this point that my father made, we see at the beginning of Shemos. Beginning of Shemos, Paro talks to his nation. Before he makes all his decrees, he says the Jewish people are a fifth column they're out to destroy us. They have lots of power, lots of influence. Remember when people used to say that we control the banks? We better outsmart them. Pen yirbe. When there'll be a war. Venosaf gamhu al sonenu, they'll join our enemies. They'll become a fifth column. Venilcham banu v'olam in aretz. So, in other words, decrees against the Jewish people don't happen just like that. For example, right now, right now, what's going on in Israel, they want to identify the Jews as child murderers. Why is it that they're sending children? They could send adults also, you know. Why are they sending children? It's not just that it's easier. They want to identify the Jewish people as child murderers. That's part of the reason. It's not just a military battle. There is a battle of perception. And to a certain degree, the Jewish people, while we might be fighting back militarily, we're not fighting the war of perception the way we could. Now, for example, today in Beit Shemesh, they tried to take control of two school buses. I listened to the news today. The only thing I heard about was Hillary Clinton. There was no mention about they're accusing us. They tried today, and luckily the bus drivers, they just shut the doors on them, so they ran into a shul and stabbed two people who were slightly wounded. It was really Nissan. But they tried to take control of two buses, two school buses in Beit Shemesh. Of course, in the news, they'll probably talk about the... About if they talk about anything, they'll say they were slightly injured, and they were then killed by the Israeli police, you know, or soldiers or whatever it was. So there is a cultural war, and it's not being fought. When the Palestinians hijacked the ship, and they took a man that was in a wheelchair, Klinghoffer, and they threw him off over the ship. The world shouldn't be allowed to forget about it. The freedom fighters. Who do the freedom fighters pick on a man in a wheelchair? Imagine if it had been the opposite, what the world would have said. And this is there is a culture war and a war of perception that it's going on, and we are not fighting that war at all. Where in the history of warfare, which nation ever called up buildings to announce that we're about to bomb the building, leave the building? Of course, it was done on a much more extensive level in Gaza. But even before 48, when they bombed the King David Hotel, they called up, and the British refused to let people know about it. When they say that we're using excessive force, ask Obama publicly, by his in the paper. Did the United States, when they bomb, and the United States has a right to bomb, did they ever call anybody up? Certainly not in Hiroshima. So how dare they talk about Israel using excessive force? It has to be repeated and repeated and repeated. But for some reason, I don't know what it is. We don't want to fight a war of perception. We want to fight. We say, you know, that we're going to defend ourselves. It's all true. But we have to point out the difference in tactics. And we have to hold them public relations-wise accountable. And let us ask the European nations. They have had wars. Did they ever call? So we have to... We don't fight this perception of war. Now, I want to discuss in Parshas Lech Lecha, I didn't study Bible criticism, but there is certain psukim in Lech Lecha that was used for the foundation of Bible criticism. And one it is on page 56, Perek Yud Beis, chapter 12, verse 6. Vayavor Avram Baretz Admo Kom Shechem Ad Elon Moreh Vahakanani Yaz Baretz. The Canaanites were then in the land. So the first question, this was the first attempt at Bible criticism. The Canaanites were then in the land. So the question is, what do you mean then in the land? If the Torah was given by Moshe Rabbeinu, the Canaanites are still in the land. What do you mean they were then in the land? Now the simple answer that Rashi gives, without asking the question, Rashi says, "V'haknani yaz ba'aretz." The Canaanites were then in the land. They were then in the land, and not beforehand in the land. In other words, the truth of the matter is that, and this is really a historical reasoning that we have to understand. In other words, v'haknani yaz ba'aretz, the Canaanites, because really Eretz Yisrael belonged to the descendants of Shem. Belonged to the descendants of Shem. And the descendants of Shem, the descendants of Shem but the Canaanites who were from Chum, they attacked the descendants of Shem, and they took control of Eretz Yisrael. So in other words, you know, it's one of the questions that's asked. Rashi mentions the beginning of Bereishis. He says that the Im Yomer Umos Halom Elistim Atem, you stole the land. So Rashi gives one answer, but there's another answer. The other answer is, we stole it. We stole it from you. Who did you steal it from? You stole it from us also. And that's something that we have to know. In other words, the truth is the Palestinians never controlled the land. But assuming that they did, but we have a prior right to the land of Eretz Yisrael. So that's one answer. But I think there is another answer, and that answer is very important. It says here about Kanani Yazbaritz, but then there is a famine in the land. Now, and it's very interesting, Avram, as soon as he comes to Eretz Yisrael, there is a famine in the land, and he has to go down to Egypt. So the question is, why did God, and this is important for us to know, why is it that God brings a famine in the land just when Avram gets there? Why didn't he? Okay, for whatever reason, there had to be a famine in the land, so tell Avram to come later. Why does he have to come in order to leave right away? But I think it's the stress. We say, Maisa Avo Simon Labanim. What happens to the patriarchs and the ancestors is a sign for the kids. A Jew has to know that he has to have a relationship with Eretz Yisrael, with the land of Israel, even when he isn't there. It was important. Avram had to come to Eretz Yisrael in order to leave Eretz Yisrael. In order that he should have set the precedent that the Jew, even when he's in Golus, even when he's in exile, he has to have a relationship with Eretz Yisrael. And this is something that is very important for us to know, especially under the circumstances, the present circumstances. Okay, so then, so the whole episode takes place, and then the famine is over, and Avram returns to Eretz Yisrael. And who does Avram go? Now Avram took with him Lot. Why did he take Lot with him? God told him, Lech lecha me'atzecha me'molaretcha me'beis avicha. Leave your land, leave your father's, leave your birthplace, and leave the house of your father. Now, the truth is, it's in the, I've mentioned many times, it's in the opposite order. First you leave your house, then you leave your city, and then you leave your country. Here it says, leave your country, leave your birthplace, and leave your house! But I heard from my father. My father would say, my father, okay, he was born in Khaslavich, which was in northern Russia, and he, the family escaped just as the communists took over. But the ultimately they went to Warsaw. So my father said it didn't take long to forget Poland. He says it took a little bit longer to forget Warsaw. He says, but what took the longest to forget was the house, the block, the house. That was what took longest. When Avram was told to leave, it wasn't just a physical leaving. It was an emotional and a cultural leaving as well. And to a certain degree, so... And we have to understand that because, you know, we want to be very nice. And there's nothing wrong with being nice. But there's nothing wrong with being... There's nothing wrong with being nice. But we have to understand that we have a certain heritage. And that heritage is not something that can be shared. The whole story of Sarah. Sarah says that next week, Sedra, Ki lo yirash, Yishmael cannot inherit together with Yitzchak. In other words, our cultures can't work together. Our cultures can't work together. It could be, I'm not advocating what Meir Kahane advocated. But, you know, the problem was when the King David Accords were made, at that time, Carter said that it's not enough to have peace in resisting war, but we have to, in a sense, and this was many among the Israelis, they saw peace as an opportunity of mixing of cultures. And this is a mistake. In other words, there's two perspectives of peace. One perspective of peace is that we're involved together, but that's not the peace that we can have. Our peace could be, and it could be in the same country. I'm not advocating. You lead your life. You have your schools. We'll lead our lives. And when it comes to the secular schools, that we can do together. But when it comes to something that's religious or whatever it is, we have to separate ourselves. It's important that you see Israel in the last 20 years has been trying to lose its Jewish identity, especially among the Labor Party. They're trying to lose the Jewish identity. At one time, the founders of the state, they could have been socialists, but they understood the importance of Jewish identity. And we're trying to, and you should know, and because we're trying to lose the Jewish identity, and this is, and I think the part of the government that is most, that is leading and advocating this is the Israeli Supreme Court. The Israeli Supreme Court, I think that they are looking for recognition from the rest of the world, so they're doing anything they can to minimize the Jewish identity of the land of Israel. So, listen, in any other country, if terrorists would kill, they would take away the house, they'd put them in prison for life, they would, in almost every other country, they would be killed on the spot. Those that are taken prisoner would certainly, what happened in India a few years ago when they went in and started shooting everybody? What happened to the people they caught? Some of them, by the way, mentally ill, who were used. One of them was told by the Muslims that he's going to have when he dies, he's going to have a halo around him. And they took him to see the dead bodies of the other terrorists, and he couldn't believe he was lied to. There was no halo over them. So these are the people, but what happened to this person who was mentally ill? So he was put in front of a firing squad. Imagine if the Israel would put an Arab terrorist in front of a firing squad. It would be front page in every newspaper in the world. We have to do our own thing. Of course, we shouldn't try to antagonize the world. But at the same time, we have to know ahead of time that we're never going to get the friendship and the devotion of the rest of the world. Now, Abraham, and here is where the issue comes. Abraham is the Roe Abraham, when they come back from Mitzrayim, the shepherds of Abraham and the shepherds of Lot get into a fight. They get into a fight, and when they have this fight, so ultimately, Avram comes to a certain realization. Abraham did not want to realize it. It took him time. Abraham, when he left, he takes Lot with him. Vayelech Avram kasher diber elav Hashem, vayelech ito Lot. So Lot goes with him, and it says, "Vayikach Avram es Sarah yishto ves Lot ben Achiv." So there are two separate expressions in regard to Lot. First, it says Lot goes with Avram, and it says Avram takes Lot. In other words, there are two set different perceptions in terms of the relationship that existed between Avram and Lot. Lot did not see himself as part of Avram's community. Avram wanted to believe that Lot was part of his community. Lot just went with Avram. But Avram felt that he's taking Lot with him. And we have this all the time. All the time! We have one perception about what the peace treaty is, and they have another perception. And it's not just Israel. With Arafat all the time, he would, in English, they would present it one way. In Arabic, they would present it another way. And then Obama with Iran. Iran stands there and says, "We're they make demonstrations against the United States. The United States is the great Satan and everything. And we're signing a peace treaty with them. We say it's Vayikach. And they say it's Vayelech. It's not even Vayelech. Look, two different perceptions. But what's the difference? The difference is Abraham. And Abraham liked Lot. He puts his life in the balance to save Lot. But Abraham realizes at a certain point he comes to say, hey, it's a mistake. We got to separate. You choose one way and I'm going to go the other way. And that's something that Obama doesn't understand. Obama is concerned about the perception, the historical perception, and because of his concern, his historical perception is going to be worse than even he could have anticipated. He's ready, he wants to, he has this need to have a peace treaty with Iran, even though Iran is openly acting in defiance of everything. They just found a underground, it was published, underground missiles. Oh, so it was in one day in the newspaper. Anybody hear anything about it afterwards? And the same thing, and unfortunately, Israel is the same thing. We had a peace treaty. Okay, whatever I think about the peace treaty, whatever somebody else thinks, the Camp David Accords, according to the original Camp David Accords, if there was an act of terrorism and the terrorist went into the territories that were controlled by the PLO, they were required to return them over to Israel. Not once was anybody ever turned over. That was our problem. Our problem was we went forth with one perception and they went forth with another perception. And we allowed that to happen. We're doing the same thing that the United States is doing with Iran. Anyway, so when Lot comes back, Avram realizes. And this is where Avram is different. Avram says, he doesn't say I made a mistake. He says it just can't go on this way. He doesn't persist on this false path. He recognizes it's not going to happen. So what does Avram say? He says, you choose one way and I'll choose the other way. I'll go the other way. If you go, and Lot goes all the way, to Sdom. And it's very interesting. The expression is, when Avram returns, the Torah says, Vahaknani Vahaprizi Azbaritz. The Canaanites and the Priziites were then in the land. In other words, there was a difference that took place between the first time Avram came in the land and the second time Avram came in the land. The first time Avram came in the land, it was the Canaanites that were in the land. The second time, when he came from Egypt, it was the Canaanites and the Priziites. Could be the Canaanites split up into two groups. It could be the Priziites, even though they're really descendants of the Canaanites. They came, there was a second group of Canaanites that came and joined them. But why does the Torah tell us? Who cares about it? Who cares about it? I think the Torah wants to tell us, what is it that led to this fight? What is it that led to this battle between the shepherds of Avram and the shepherds of Lot? They seemed to get along so well before. What happened? The answer is, Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, I always mention, says, Minag HaYehudim, the custom of the Jewish people, Afilu HaTov Shebehem, even the good ones among them, Kaminag HaGayim Asher B'Socham Heim Yoshvim, is like the custom of the nations in whose midst they dwell. When it was just Canaanites, we had to worry about influences. But when there was peace among them, there was peace in Avram's camp also. But when there was a dispute between the Canaanites and the Perizzites, when the Canaanites divided into two camps, and each fighting with the other, they didn't divide just like that, because they were fighting with each other. They wanted a separate identity. So what was in the back of Lot's mind now became a reality, because they saw how others are acting. The influence, I think that's our problem. Our problem is that we are being influenced by the foolishness of the United States. The United States, because a peace treaty is so important to them, they're willing to say, we'll view it one way and the others will view it the other way. It's two peace treaties. We have one peace treaty and they have another peace treaty. And the problem is that there is a possibility that Israel, unfortunately, because of the influence of the United States, Israel had this approach under Rabin. Hopefully Netanyahu will have a different approach. But it's something that we have to constantly be on guard. We constantly have to be on guard that the influences of the nations around us shouldn't have an impact. Shouldn't have an impact on the way we think. When I say those who are our supporters, everybody says that Israel is our best friend. Israel is our best friend. But Israel has to look at what isn't good for it. You know, even when it comes to Iran, the United States doesn't feel the immediate danger of Iran. They can afford to be stupid a little bit longer. Israel is dealing with a different problem. Israel, it's not an issue of tomorrow or 20 years down the road. It's an immediate problem. And as we see, it's not even a question of raising armies. Individuals go in and start stabbing people. So this is what we have to understand. We have to say, why does it say first Vahaknani Yazbaritz and then Vahaknani Vahaprizim Yazbaritz? It's not to compare before and after, it's to compare the two situations. When Avram first came in the land, the Oz means when Avram first came in the land. The second Oz is when Avram came the second time in the land. To compare, that we should understand that the impact, the way the nations of the world act, that has an impact on the way we will act. And that's what we have to stand up for Israel. We have to have a relationship with Israel, as I mentioned, even when we're in Golis. And we can't say, well, if the United States acts stupid, that's reason for Israel to act stupid. We have to point out, and at the same time, we have to have this public relations war. We have to constantly remind the world, to the point that they'll be sick about it, about the difference, the way Israel fights a war and the way the other nations of the world fight the war.
Everybody to please clean off your tables, leave the tablecloths on the tables. And in about 3 minutes, we're going to be davening Maariv. Once again, no class next week. There will not be a class next week. The week after, there will be.